Welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Kevan Davani. My very special guest is Jameson Lopp. Jameson, thanks so much for coming on my show.
My pleasure. How are you doing?
I think I saw you in Riga and in Berlin on both occasions.
That is correct.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay. Otherwise, unfortunately, we didn't have any opportunity or time. I would have loved to do this like in person, but maybe we can catch up later on or next event. So, Jameson, I have a bunch of questions, of course, for myself. But since I've gone through your treasure trove of materials. And I've listened to some of your interviews, which you have posted on your own website, lop.net. Then you have this other website, it's called Satoshi.info. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit later on that.
Sure.
And the other one, that's the same thing, lop.net. So I can suggest anyone of my listeners and viewers just check it out. It's really a treasure trove of interviews, material resources, educational materials. This is what my podcast show Bitcoin Only is about, inspiring. Now I must say, Jameson, I'm not a technologist. I'm not technical. I can't deal anything with technical jargon. So I'm trying really with this the name of my podcast is the Total Connector, and the name itself implies that I'm really attempting my best to connect the dots or inspire people for themselves to to educate themselves, to empower themselves with really multifaceted knowledge that Bitcoin brings with itself. Now, you can talk about anything you want. You have at least a full hour if you want, but I do have some specific questions regarding especially the CASA, full node, security, privacy, the adoption rate or the adoption possibilities. I also have a little bit of questions about the Trezor, the advanced and non-advanced mode. So how do you want to do this? Do you want me to go question after question, or should we zoom out a little bit? And maybe I think it's a good idea. I want to ask you, what is Bitcoin for you? What's the essence, the purpose, the intention, the wish behind Bitcoin? And do you think we could be much further if there weren't specific obstacles or challenges, for mass adoption?
Yeah, it makes sense to begin at the beginning. What is Bitcoin? And, that is something that people have been arguing about ever since the project began. To me, this is all a grand experiment to try to create a new form of money that is an open collaborative project. That is the fundamental reason why I got interested and involved years ago, was because I had never really thought about money or how it worked. But once I read the white paper and I started thinking about money at a more specific level rather than just using whatever was given to me, I thought, hey, it makes sense that this is an abstract concept that kind of belongs to humanity. So why shouldn't it be a project where anyone who cares can give their input and try to, reshape the way that money actually operates? Now, of course, this creates a lot of complexities because you're going from a system that is essentially controlled by a small number of people who can probably easily come to a consensus about what money should be, to basically a free-for-all where, there is no traditional hierarchical governance system. This anarchy, as it were, is a lot more difficult to understand, and people are trying to apply different forms of governance to it, and so far all of those attempts have failed. So this is a continuing experiment because no one really fully understands what it is that we have built here. Like, people are still poking at the system and trying to understand how it responds to different things and how we can evolve it over time. And of course, this is why we have conferences all over the world to try to get people to come together to discuss, what are our options And amongst those potential options, which ones do we think are the safest and the sanest and are possible to actually implement while causing the least amount of harm and disruption to the existing users? So this is something where you can basically go as deep as you want. And I've gone really, really deep over the years and have still only really scratched the surface. And I think that as you showed with some of the resource pages that I maintain, I think I have over 700 or 800 linked resources on there. And that actually becomes a pretty decent part-time job in and of itself, just trying to maintain this comprehensive list of resources and at least organize it in a way so that it's not too overwhelming for people, because you could easily get lost in there and never find your way out of the rabbit hole.
Yeah. So James, that's fascinating. Why don't you tell me or tell my listeners what was your path to Bitcoin? I mean, what's the fundamental, root cause of our monetary, and economical, financial, social problems? Do we have to remind, as Eric Voskuhl always says, and you've been in a lot of conversations and discussion, panel discussion also with him on different conferences I've seen and I've experienced myself. So it's real fascinating. Do we need to remind people? I mean, do you think people really understand what the problem is in regards to separation of state, government, nation state, whatever, and money? Do you think people understand the seriousness of the situation we are in right now?
Well, no. I mean, most people don't have the time to worry about these things. You know, most people are just worried about where their next paycheck is going to come from. You know, on the sort of, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I think a lot of people have their food pretty well taken care of in most countries, but are still trying to get to that next level where their shelter and their other bills are something that they actually have to worry about, because they don't have sufficient financial reserves, and they have to keep replenishing them. They have to keep earning money and being able to take care of themselves and pay off their debts and all these other things. And so you pretty much have to get like all of your needs taken care of to get to the point where you have enough free time where you can start worrying about things like politics or economics or, these greater, higher level issues with civilization. So I don't expect that we'll ever get to the point where most or even many people worry about this type of stuff. But I also don't think it's necessary that everyone has to understand it, everyone has to worry about it. There are a number of different studies that have shown that, in order to enact meaningful change, you only really need a small, like single digit percentage of the populace to become very, very interested in getting change to happen. And so I think that while we should try to educate as many people as possible, it's fine if the vast majority of people don't have the time or resources to worry about this stuff.
Yeah. You said a couple of very, very, very essential, important things. First of all, yeah, I do agree with you. It's people don't have the time. They don't have the, but it is, the situation is a little bit schizophrenic, because I'm in Austria, wherever, Europe, Western, developed country, whatever. And then you got the other countries like Venezuela, Turkey, Argentina, Iran, high inflation, hyperinflation, sanctions, embargoes, real suffering. The pain point has been reached. They feel it and they go into action. You don't need to do much explaining, even though, most of them probably still don't know what, how Bitcoin really works, Do I don't. I mean, I've been in this rabbit hole for 3 years and I'm still learning and learning, and you're going into deeper and deeper rabbit holes. But there is something in between. I mean, either people, I think people over here in Western developed countries, Western states, they are much more, they are, they feel comfortable. I mean, that's the argument they give me, like spontaneously. Anybody, who you ask, it's like, what do you need Bitcoin for? I can, pay my proverbial coffee with this and that. And then on the other extreme, you've got people who feel the social, economical, real existential threat. And so I'm trying here to find, I think this is what we're, why we're doing this also, or why that's the intention of my podcast also, and so many other educational materials. There's so many, you know, wonderful podcasters, beginning with Steve Levera and Peter McCormack, and you know, all these people out there. I think they all have understood, comprehended the ethos, the logic, the only choice option we have with Bitcoin. And to be honest with you, I mean, very frank, I think we're going to be fucked as hell if we cannot, implement or mass adopt Bitcoin as soon as possible. And you talked about, I think, this critical mass or something like that, like a marginal number of people that triggers this maybe this chain reaction. I'm just paraphrasing here. But do you see there's an opportunity here? Is there ways to improve the educational process, the technological process, the implementation? Do you think there could be more communication, cooperation?
Yeah, so it's really weird. You noted a number of really good educators in the space, and I think one of the problems is there's a big disconnect, and it's almost kind of ironic that it seems like the vast majority of the education and discussion and resources are all in English. I know there are some people who work on translating things into other languages, but it's almost kind of ironic that I think the people who could benefit the most from this technology do not have the same level of educational resources available to them. I think there's also some really big disconnects between the East and the West, mainly due to language and cultural barriers. It's very hard for me and probably a lot of other people to understand, you know, what is going on in China and Russia, for example, with their Bitcoin communities. And so they may have a very different understanding and perspective of what Bitcoin is. And, you know, that can potentially cause a lot of issues in the future. But the other thing, though, is that I don't believe that the technology is currently available to scale in the way that we want it to. So I'm kind of okay with the fact that not everyone is using Bitcoin right now, because it would actually not work very well if we got everyone onto a Bitcoin, unless they were using Bitcoin through third-party custodians, which, you know, is not the way that we want them to use it. And that is a debate in and of itself. There are some people who believe that even if Bitcoin never scaled the way we want it to, that even if most people were using Bitcoin banks or exchanges, that it would still be an improvement on the current system, because you would still be able to do things like audit the total supply and, you know, prevent runaway inflation and whatnot. But of course, you know, we want to try to make this system the best that possibly can be in every possible way. And it's a very big challenge to do that. And it's going to take a lot of time and effort to continue to make these incremental improvements.
Mm-hmm. After this Lightning Conference in Berlin, what's your position now? What's your take? What is your view on the degree of improvement, of implementation, of how far are we, you know, or from your perspective, what are the problems, the challenges when it comes to Lightning, this second layer? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's so unbelievable. Sometimes, like, it's 2019, it's the year 2019, and we still haven't figured out how people can transact freely. I mean, this is what it all boils down to, right? I mean, freely, without censorship, and with the hardest and scarcest money. I mean, we're getting there, but where do you see the problem challenges? How can we improve it?
Yeah, I mean, digital scarcity is hard. Building secure systems on the internet is hard. That's really the trade-off. You know, when you're moving outside of this like closed ecosystem or walled garden where, you know, one entity controls it and they can put up, you know, really intensive security measures because they control everything, versus going to a completely open system, kind of turns everything on its head, requires a lot more work on the security side. But, you know, the thing with Lightning is that we're creating this new economic network where it's never really existed before. Requiring liquidity to actually exist in a like provably, cryptographic sense, rather than just being able to make up numbers and push them over the internet between, central banks or whatever. So there are many issues both on the sort of economic and liquidity side, also on the security side, because, now we're going back to more of a hot wallet model than a cold wallet. And also really the presentation that I gave in the Lightning conference in Berlin was all about what's really required to get enterprises onto the Lightning network. And that's going to be very important from a liquidity side, but the enterprises have much higher standards for robustness and risk. So we need a lot of improvements on the technical side for their like day-to-day operations. So, this is, once again, it's going to be years of effort and what we're doing at Casa and what a lot of other companies are doing with Lightning is they are running, these risky services, and they are encountering failures, and they're learning from the failures, and they're continuing to iterate and improve upon it. And it's very difficult to extrapolate to say, oh, we just need to have, this many more years of failures before enterprises will be in an acceptable position to adopt it. It's going to be a gradual thing. That's why there is, the whole like Lightning Network is going to be ready in 18 months meme is kind of a running joke, is that, software is never done. There's never going to be a point at which we say, okay, we don't have to do anything more for Lightning Network. Like, there's always going to be more room for improvement.
But better than 2 weeks, because Max Hillebrand always has 2 weeks, right?
I think 18 months is a better expectation, because it's far enough away that people will forget about whatever promises you made 18 months ago. But it's... it could go into a lot of deep technical weeds about the potential improvements, but there's even more potential improvements at the base layer that could result in orders of magnitude of improvement at the second layer with Lightning Network. So there is a huge amount of potential things that could happen over the coming years, and hopefully they will all happen. And you can get very hand wavy about talking about things like basically like shared Lightning channels between hundreds or thousands of people, and ways to continue to get orders of magnitude improvement. But as it stands right now, that's still all on the like to-do list. So, I don't think that we're going to be at, mainstream adoption levels anytime, even in the next few years.
All right. You talk about institutions like enterprises. Now I know it's all about trial and error, and it's like life. We've got to learn and comprehend consciously out of these mistakes and errors. But do you think institutions could bring like a positive trajectory into this development? Like in terms of you mentioned liquidity. Custodial. I think it's inevitable. There will be people who will need custodial, right? There's no other way to do this other than custodial. So there's going to be a majority, a number of people. How do you think institutions could contribute to this process positively, or in terms of speed? Or,
well, I mean, I suspect that most of them are just going to be, building their own systems or integrating the Lightning technology into their existing systems. It would be great if some of them came in and started contributing at the protocol layer, but I mean, we already saw, on the Bitcoin protocol side, even as many different large companies came forward and were even making billions of dollars a year, very few, if any of them, ended up contributing much back to the protocol itself. Mm-hmm. So that's not something that I would hold out too much hope for. If anything, the institution stuff is, I think, more later phase of, once the technology is more mature, then they will adopt it, and that will onboard more people.
So it's going to take years, that's for sure. Yeah. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a realistic assessment. Yeah, I guess. Well, then let me ask you a couple of specific questions, and then we'll come back. Maybe we'll zoom out again. The Casa Full Node, I finally ordered it. I'm waiting. We're waiting for all for the version 2.
Yep.
Now, if I may say that, I mean, the average person like myself, let's say, can afford that, no problem. It's $300, and then you've got additional $300 subscription free per year. Do you think it is feasible to for this normal package, it's called the golden version, to lower the price in or and then maybe through competition or I don't know, or through further development, make this a little bit more affordable for people, for the lower class, like below middle
Well, I
class?
mean, a lot of that comes down to, what is the cheapest hardware that is available. And so, we're trying to get, small form factor, Raspberry Pi type hardware, which all in all, I think, Raspberry Pi boards usually go for like $50 to $100. But then you need like some decent storage, which is probably going to be another $100. And then of course there is the actual cost of all the software that we write and the support that we give. I think we also throw in a hardware wallet device as well. So I think if we're talking about ways to get new hardware shipped to people to run as nodes, you're going to be hard pressed to ever get that below the probably $100 to $150 price point. And that is assuming hardware only. That is if the user is then going to go get some software and install it and basically set up everything themselves. It's definitely possible to get your own new hardware node running up for that level of cost. The only way to get what I would say is a really cheap, affordable node is to you reuse old hardware that you already have laying around. Maybe you have a like 5-year-old or 10-year-old laptop or desktop that's just sitting in a closet. That would be essentially free to get up and running. And the nice thing about all of the Bitcoin and Lightning software is that it's not that computationally intensive. You can run it on really old hardware. It'll be a little bit slower, but it'll still do what it's meant to do. So from that perspective, if we're talking about like how would we get people in third world countries running nodes and all of that, I think it would probably be more along those lines of repurposing old hardware because you can get the software for free. But once again, that still does require at least small amount of technical ability and time and resources to set that up. So what we're aiming for with Casa, it is not going to be the cheapest solution. We're not trying to onboard absolutely everybody. Right now, our target audience is, the enthusiast who has some extra money that they'd be willing to spend, but they don't have the technical savvy, or they just don't have the time to get in there and, run the software and maintain it. And we're trying to lower the bar on the technical side for people to be able to take advantage of running a full node and self-custodying their own keys. And there are plenty of costs involved to all the development that we have to do to make things easier for people.
I mean, yeah, it just the subscription fee, which I think could be, done away with. I mean, the subscription fee is for like losing a key, so so people have that service, 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5 keys, right? Multi-signature, is that the service, subscription fee
Right.
for?
So, the thing about Casa is we're not just selling a node. We have an entire suite of products, and they're meant to work together to get you the best like self-sovereignty solution available. And so the subscription is really for support and continued like access to the multi-sig setup and recovery from certain failure scenarios if something goes wrong there. And also, if we were just selling nodes standalone, then it gets kind of weird from a support perspective of what happens now that there's going to be like a secondary market with, you know, V1 nodes floating around. You know, how much support do we want to give to people who, you know, we don't know how they actually got their node because they didn't buy it from us.
Yeah. So, but still updates would be anytime possible, right? Yeah. Okay. You mentioned in one of your interviews that I listened to was called Bitcoin Custody and Key Management on the Blockchain VC podcast. You said it's actually with the Cosmonaut, you know, comes that this Trezor hardware wallet. So it is not actually, because of that service, it is actually not advised to write down that seed phrase or the mnemonic phrase. Could you elaborate on that? Or do you think it could still be useful sort of as a last joker? I'm just, you know, thinking worst case scenario, what if something goes totally bust and, you know, the company or you would still have that seed?
To be clear, the Trezor that we are sending is meant to be used in the Casa multi-sig wallet. So
okay. Gotcha.
The basic multi-sig is 2 out of 3. We also have a 3 out of 5 key shield that's a sort of more premium tier. And if you want to understand more about our seedless model, the best thing to do is actually go on our website and look at our wealth security protocol, which is, it's like 50 or 60 pages of in-depth explanation of every possible attack and loss vector that we've thought through when we were designing our multi-sig wallets and basically how we mitigate against those things. And we do specifically talk about the seed issue, and that this is, as far as I'm aware, we are the only wallet out there that actually has this seedless setup, where the thesis that we built this all upon is that asking the user to do anything technical or to have any like special security knowledge is a foot gun, if you will. It creates a lot of possibilities for failure, and we should not assume that the user has any particular knowledge or expertise. And the problem that we kept running into when we were thinking about, well, you know, what do you actually do when you set up a multi-sig wallet with hardware devices? Well, when you go plug in your hardware device for the first time, it says, okay, these are your 12 or 24 words, write them down, keep them in a safe place. And if you think about it, that sentence has an entire iceberg of like technical and security knowledge underneath it that it just completely glosses over. And we realized, you know, we can't assume that the user knows how to keep a seed phrase safe, or that the user is going to follow the best practices for putting their seed phrase like in a tamper evident bag in an access controlled location and having, you know, multiple redundant backups and yada, yada, yada. And so instead, we said, okay, user should throw away the seed, and we will instead keep the security model that is visualized within our application as the different devices in your multi-sig setup. And the nice thing about using these hardware devices is that you can do things like have health checks. And so if you're not sure if your hardware device is still good, then you just go into the app and you click on health check and you plug in your hardware device and you sign a cryptographic message, which can then, you know, validate that the device is working as intended. If anything goes wrong, if you lose a device, it stops working, whatever, we actually built in this key rotation mechanism into the application. So you just go buy a new Trezor, Ledger, what have you. You can buy it from us. You can buy it from the manufacturer. Doesn't really matter. And initialize it, plug it in, and we actually walk you through basically sweeping the funds off of the existing multi-sig and sending them to the new multi-sig setup with that new device, replacing the other one. And so We believe this is a much more flexible system. You're able to respond to threats and losses a lot faster. And it's just easier to think about logically from a security perspective, because you don't have potentially plain text, you know, clear text seed phrases floating around who knows where throughout the world. We know that the private keys are all secured within specialized hardware.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you my opinion or my feeling why that is actually a really good idea and advantage is because of, you know, personal experience that, you know, when you have a Trezor, you need to do regular updates or whatever in whenever it's needed. And I remember the last one of the last updates, it was 1.8.3 on Trezor 1, the first model. It literally asked me to type in the whatever the 24 mnemonic phrase into the keyboard and then into the browser. Now, and I already told Trezor that, or whatever the responsible decision makers, I told them it would have been really advisable or wise to tell the customers that, or warn them that maybe it should, you know, maybe they should do the advanced mode so that whatever they click or they confirm the 12 or 24 words on the device itself and not on the keyboard. And I think that's a really dangerous risk people are going, you know, with whatever key loggers and all these things. I mean, so would the, first of all, my question is, would the update still be done? You would still have, the customer would still have to do the updates, right, on the Trezor itself, right?
So this is an interesting question, actually. Though with regard to what you were saying, that's actually, it's particularly scary because there have been a number of malicious Trezor wallet websites that have popped up that ask you to type in your seed phrase. Mm. So that's actually something that I've written a blog post about. I haven't published yet, but I'll be discussing a lot of issues with any browser-based operations with wallets, because that just creates a huge attack surface. But with regard to the actual firmware updates, it's kind of interesting. I've looked into this myself. Not all firmware updates actually wipe the device. It seems like only the firmware updates that are patching like a vulnerability with an exploit where the seed could get extracted end up doing that. And so this is something that we actually stay on top of, and we inform our customers if we believe it's something that they need to do. But most of the time, we actually find that it's not really necessary for our users to update their firmware, because the old firmware continues to work fine. And in some cases, even when it is a security update, we find that it is actually not really changing the security model of our setup, because our setup uses multiple geographically distributed devices. So even if an exploit was used against one of the devices that was, you know, physically taken by an attacker, that would not be sufficient for your wallet to be compromised.
Yeah, I mean, I had an email correspondence back and forth with Trezor, and they told me, yeah, you know, there's an option advanced mode. And I said, well, it would have been nice if I had known about, you know, maybe I don't know, maybe I didn't read the instructional manual of you know, dozens of pages first, but I'm, you know, always, you know, speaking from the perspective of an average user. So if I had known that, I would have already activated the advanced mode, and I wouldn't have, you know, in case of a firmware update, type in the words into the keyboard and, you know, into the browser. I mean, that's totally crazy. But, you know, maybe they've improved. I hope I've done some constructive feedback. And but from a security standpoint, I think that's pretty risky stuff. I mean, yeah. Just wanted to.
Was that with the Trezor 1? Because at least with the Model T, you should be able to actually do more things on the screen.
Yeah, Trezor 1. Yeah, that's the issue, because the Trezor, the Model T, sort of the second version, the extended version, is already by default, right? Only display on its device. So, you know, I mean, we talk about security, privacy, and that's the whole point, you know, of having a hardware wallet. This is not a criticism. You know, I'm just saying that, you know, as a feedback, maybe it could have been done by default. That's the only thing I'm saying. Why isn't the advanced mode not by default? You know, But otherwise, you know, I'm really, you know, I'm one of the hugest fans of Trezor, and now from now on Kaza, because it's really, I'm total fan of, because this is really what is needed in this space, you know, user friendly, user experience, ease of use, intuitive, you know, handling, without needing to understand, I don't know, you know, how the internet works, email, you just, you know, go in, pop it up, you know, and you do your stuff, you know. So I'm just hoping and wishing that this you know, this aspect could be more, you know, worked on.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the issues, I think, with security. I mean, you're always making a trade-off of usability versus security. And with a lot of the security-focused companies, I think that they you know, they focus on security sometimes to the detriment of usability. And I think that's one of the unique things about Kaza is we're definitely focusing on security, but we also have a very high priority for usability. And you know, that's something we have a lot of arguments about is, you know, what are the acceptable trade-offs for us that we're willing to make to make the usability basically at a higher level than you find with most of the other software out there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me see if I have a couple of other questions. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't want to repeat questions which I've already discussed or elaborated on those, you know, excellent interviews and podcasts. People should just check it out on lop.net/interviews. It's really a treasure trove of information, knowledge, and wisdom, and really for the sake of comprehension. So, all right, you talked about challenges for the Lightning Network, engineering the liquidity in automatic fashion, user understanding channels, Bitcoin wallet only. Oh, this is really an awesome topic or subtopic. Bitcoin wallet only. You talked about the Bitcoin wallet only, or Bitcoin wallet, which does everything by default or automatically. Were you talking about like interoperability sort of? I'm just paraphrasing it, you know, vice versa. Bitcoin wallet, Lightning Network, Bitcoin wallet, maybe even coin mixing, everything by default. Would that be the ultimate solution?
Yeah, well, from the like when will Lightning Network go mainstream standpoint, I don't think that that will happen until we can abstract away a lot of these low-level issues like channel management and liquidity. And really, you have to ask yourself, does it even make sense that a user needs to know the difference between funds that are in a Lightning channel versus funds that are just on chain? The user just wants to make a payment. I mean, they want to pay somebody. They don't really care how it happens. They just want it to happen, and they don't want to have to like manually open channels and figure out liquidity issues and all this other stuff. So that is one of the long-term challenges with all of this, is to figure out how do we take all of these issues that are currently being manually managed by advanced enthusiast users and write software that basically replicates whatever the actions that humans are doing right now, so that in the future, all of that stuff can be done by the software, and all the user has to do is, you know, point and click and, you know, scan a QR code, and the payment just happens under the hood.
Great. So I want to talk, like we have got approximately 20 minutes. I want to have a little bit your, you know, broader perspective, your bigger picture on the situation that we have right now, geopolitically, macroeconomically. We could have a recession by the end of next year, 2020, and that these are experts, you know, saying this. We could have, you know, the ultimate dream of the International Monetary Fund or whatever central banks to establish a cashless society. Mm-hmm. Do you think all these factors with inflation, hyperinflation, negative rate interest policy, maybe even negative bail-in on depositing accounts, this could accelerate the process, you know, of people flocking? It's like, you know, where I'm going to store my wealth, you know, how I'm going to, you know, circumvent the capital control or inflation, hyperinflation, bail-in.
Yeah, there's a school of thought that Bitcoin doesn't necessarily have to evolve much all it has to do is not fail, because it seems pretty much guaranteed that the existing system is going to fail in multiple ways. How catastrophically is it going to fail? That's, you know, up for debate, but it's clear that a lot of people are going to be harmed, and those are the people who are then going to be incentivized to look into alternative solutions. So that is another reason why I think that it's important that we continue trying to scale the system to make it more user-friendly, you know, so that when those people find themselves in a situation where they're looking for alternatives, they don't find Bitcoin to be too onerous to take advantage of.
Jameson, what is your vision? Let's say once, for the sake of imagination, what do you think would happen once Bitcoin becomes so implemented and so, I don't know, ossified, implemented, monetary root layering is fully developed? This is one of my favorite questions, because it goes back, to also Safed and Amu's book, page 96 to 98, where it compares, the 19th and 20th century. I also, by the way, I talked also very interestingly to Adam Back about this in my interview with him. So I want to have your position, your perspective. What do you think could change? Like, what would be the chain reaction on a social, scientific, technological, structural level for our society, for our human civilization?
Well, I mean, there's certainly plenty of utopian ideals of what may happen with all of that. One of the biggest questions, I think, is what are the things that are currently being bought and paid for via inflation or via, manipulation of the money supply? And if that manipulation is no longer possible, what are the side effects of all of that? And so while, some people talk about things like, taxation is going to become impossible and that's going to starve the nation state and whatever, I don't necessarily believe that, because as long as we are like physical beings that must reside within some sort of geographic boundary that is controlled by a military-backed nation state, they're probably going to be able to find you and, extract some resources from you. So I think the more logical question is what happens when the starvation of inflation occurs. And so that, will probably have some major ripple effects through the banking system, the economy, will result in geopolitical changes, because actually this happened during the Facebook or Libra hearings last week. There was a senator who he came right out and he said, Mr. Zuckerberg, America prefers to use the dollar as a tool to basically pressure our enemies financially. We would much rather do that than, send troops into an enemy country. And so, that really struck me with how transparent they were about the weaponization of the dollar. Of course, I think most people are familiar with the petrodollar and how that could have some major ripple effects if the dollar was no longer like the primary denomination for trading oil and potentially other large commodity markets. But I'm not an economist. I don't necessarily know how that's all going to play out. There are folks who are hoping for hyper Bitcoinization, and that maybe like Bitcoin ends up replacing the dollar as a unit of account for many things, which would be of course great for anyone in the Bitcoin space. But before that happens, I mean, I think there is going to be a lot of turmoil, and the unfortunate part of all this is, change often helps people, but it often hurts people as well. It hurts the incumbents who are currently benefiting from whatever the rules of the current system are. And what's very difficult to predict is how desperate those incumbents will become and what things they might do to try to, you know, grasp at retaining the last bits of the power that they see slipping away from them. So the only thing that I am fairly confident about is that, you know, the world is going to continue to get weirder and more complex and potentially more chaotic.
Very good point to make. Eric Vascoolum, you know, personally anyway, he writes this on Libit coin, his articles, and there was this discussion on Twitter, other means principle, it's called. And I'm just going to, you know, quote a sentence out of it. I just want to know your thoughts about this. He says, this conflict, you know, in connection with Bitcoin, this conflict between state and individuals for control of money will pass through up to four phases anticipated by the Bitcoin security model. These may overlap and vary regionally, but are each clearly identifiable. First, honeymoon. Second, black market. Third, competition. And fourth, surrender. So there's this process, obviously, that that it sounds logical also to me, you know, because it won't be like without sort of a fight or a conflict or resistance. Where do you see this going? I mean, do you see this process, this evolution, like with in regards to states, nation states, and seigneurage, taxes? This is the whole point, I guess. We're paying taxes, so is this going to change?
Well, on the bright side, I think that a lot of the fears that governments were going to clamp down and completely ban Bitcoin and, you know, kick down people's doors, that has mostly gone away. You know, sure, there are a few countries that have effectively banned it, but even, you know, just in the past few weeks, we've seen, you know, China start to talk about blockchain technology initiatives and completely reversing some of their bans on various speech around this technology. And so I'm optimistic that at least in a lot of the Western countries and you know, potentially others as well, it seems like a lot of politicians are already invested in and benefiting from Bitcoin. And so from that perspective, it's already kind of infected the government, hopefully to the extent that a lot of these governments would not be willing to ban it because the politicians would actually be harming themselves. And so it's an interesting juxtaposition of the benefits to the individuals who are even part of the government versus the government as a whole, which is clearly not going to benefit from having a competitive monetary system. But it's just, that's what you have to look at, right? Is you have to look at the incentives and the game theory, and it seems to be working out pretty well so far.
Yeah, it seems they're doing us a really great favor, I always say, you know, this, because everything is sort of, a lot of things are working out independently from one another, but it's still connected. So all these processes, you know, with China and whatever federal chairman, the chairman of Federal Reserve or Donald Trump or the Treasury Secretary making statement, now the hearings in the Congress. And as you say, you know, now they are, they've got skin in the game now, a lot of them, right? Decision makers, lawmakers, politicians, regulators. So it's really a fascinating time we live in. So James, first of all, I want to really appreciate your sharing knowledge. Would you for the last whatever 10 minutes we have left, anything essential, like somebody would come up to you totally, you know, not knowledgeable about Bitcoin, what would be like the essential information you would give him or her to, you know, if this person is inspired or open-minded, where would you send him to? I mean, where should he start in the rabbit hole?
Well, I specifically have a getting started page on my website, which is, you know, a bunch of non-technical explanations. I think we've even got some, like, you know, cartoons and animated stuff there that it kind of explains the system at a really high level as, you know, a way of proving ownership of assets and transferring assets, you know, without a third party. Yeah, it was the getting started link. You were right there on Bitcoin resources. Yeah, getting started is right there on the left.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, first steps, you know, basic facts, frequently asked questions. But then, like, the, you know, explain Bitcoin like I'm five will be able to be understood by most people. And then, you know, I have plenty of other more in-depth technical explanations if people really care. But I also say that the Bitcoin white paper is actually a pretty easy read. Most people probably hear white paper and they think, oh, this is going to be really technical and above my head. But Satoshi wrote the white paper in fairly plain terms. There's not a whole lot of technical jargon in there. And even if it is too much, I've got like some annotated versions of the white paper that, that go into even more detail of explaining, you know, exactly what any of the technical explanations are. And so, you know, you don't necessarily even have to understand what any of those like algorithms or functions are in there.
Right.
I think the diagrams explain a lot.
Yeah.
but
can I ask you something, Jameson? The first time you read, because I hear this from a lot of people, you know, who are real, and even Andreas Antonopoulos, like reading it the first time, people just brush it away. Was that in your case too, or did you like, did it make click in your head, in your brain?
No, I definitely dismissed Bitcoin the first few times that I just heard about it in the news, but then, you know, the third or fourth or fifth time or whatever that it kept coming up, I decided, okay, it's not dying. I should probably look into it. And so that is when I actually read the white paper. And when I read the white paper, I was pretty amazed. I was like, this is actually an amazing solution to a computer science problem that I had never even really thought about. And so that intrigued me because I have a computer science degree, and so it got me interested from a technical standpoint. But of course, I was also simultaneously interested just from a philosophical sort of libertarian standpoint as well. And the white paper does not explain actually quite a few things. There are a ton of things that are missing from the white paper, but it does a great job of explaining just the high level concepts of how do you build a system that is not reliant upon trusted third parties to come to consensus.
Gotcha. Yeah. I just found the annotated version of yours. Really great. Yeah. It's wow. What a treasure trove of information. This is great. This is great stuff. Yeah. People need to, I mean, you know, take upon their self responsibility and educate themselves. I mean, all we can do is really give them the inspirations. The knowledge is really there. It's open source. It's freely available. And there's tons of really excellent material with a podcast, videos, interviews, articles written on medium.com. It's just endless.
Yeah, but here's the thing about all of the education and resources. The reason why people should be doing that and educating themselves is because it is such a new system. It's still risky. It's still complicated. If we get to the point where this is a mainstream adopted thing, then people won't need to educate themselves about much of it at all, except maybe that they need to, you know, have a backup of their seed phrase or something. Other than that, you know, it's just like the internet. Like you said, you don't know how the internet works or email works. It's because the people who were using it, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they had to educate themselves about how it was working at a low level because not many layers of abstraction had been built on top of it to make it user friendly. You had to know how to get on the command line and, you know, dial your modem into like a specific telephony based ISP and you know, potentially even configure the like frequency and baud of your modem and all this other stuff. But now, you know, people just go buy a mobile phone and start tapping around on it, and they can accomplish amazing things. And I fully expect the same thing is going to happen with Bitcoin, Lightning, and any other technologies that are built on top of it, is that we get to the point where it's so easy to use. You know, you can basically hand a phone or a tablet to a toddler, and they can start working their way through and making payments without asking anybody for permission.
Great. So, Jameson, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. I really appreciate your commitment, you know, your ethos, you know, all your work you do in the background. If you had like a one title that you would give this interview, what would it be? What have we talked about, in essence? Is it about freedom? Is it about adoption? Is it about evolution? What is it about? Is it about, you know, what is it?
Well, I mean, I think that we've mostly covered just the complexity of this space. It is, and it continues to be a system that is so complicated and has so many different facets to it that you can choose one of them and dig in as deep as you want to, or you can, you know, try to go broad and cover a lot at a high level. But you know, the ultimate issue with, I think, education and trying to learn more about stuff in this space is that everyone should just follow their own path. I often get questions from people of like, you know, I want to contribute to this space, you know, what do I need to learn, or you know, what should I contribute to this space? And ultimately, that because there is no authority, there is no project manager, there's no real way to specifically point people to a specific path to say, you know, this is the path that you have to take. I think that everyone has to take their own path and explore whatever pieces of the system they find most interesting. And you know, if you're non-technical, then you're probably not going to go down the technical side, but maybe you're more interested in the economics or the finance or aspects of like governance and consensus. Bitcoin needs to have as many, you know, experts in different areas as possible, because this is an organic, open community movement. As long as people are educating themselves about something, then that will give you the ability to contribute back with whatever discussions arise in the future about what we need to do to make this system better.
Beautiful said. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Jameson, thank you so much for, you know, sharing your time, your knowledge, and your wisdom, and hope to see you soon, maybe on some other event, conference, or maybe on a panel discussion. And yeah, appreciate everything you do, and hope to, yeah, talk to you soon again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye.
Welcome to the podcast show by Kay Vandavani, The Total Connector, Total Bitcoin, Austrian Economics, the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, Bitcoin.